Nobody can be too Jewish.
That's exactly it. You got it.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Emily Wanderer Cohen, child and grandchild of Holocaust survivors, and creator of the Right to Heal process for survivors' descendants, and the author of From Generation to Generation, Healing Intergenerational Trauma Through Storytelling. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our two Jewish Mevina on Israel, Oshrat Barel, and our Shinchinim Chen Denachi and Tamir Shukuri. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. I was watching a fun TV show the other day on Netflix called The Good Place, which is about the afterlife. It's a very entertaining, funny program starring Ted Danson and Kristen Bell, who are both brilliant, by the way, and is very high on philosophical explorations of what it means to be a good person. The Good Place is not really about life after death, but about the various ways in which we can explore virtue, altruism, and responsibility to others in this life. But, of course, that's probably the point. I remember very well an encounter I had about 3 years ago during my sabbatical trip around the world. I visited a high-ranking member of the Greek Orthodox Patriarchate in Istanbul, Turkey. Although he was an important prelate and a top assistant to the Greek Orthodox Patriarch himself, he'd actually grown up in suburban Chicago, spoke English fluently, and we had a wonderful conversation about theology and ritual. As I tried to understand the intricacies of the Greek Church, he explained carefully to me how central the concept of the rewards of eternal life are for Orthodox Christians. The goal for every believing person in his faith is to achieve eternal reward in a much better world than this one. As the TV show might call it, the good place. And then he said, I don't understand how you can get people to be good if they aren't trying to get to heaven and are deeply afraid of going to hell. I did my best to explain that in Judaism we seek to inspire people to live ethical lives by observing mitzvot, fulfilling commandments designed to make life moral and holy. And I told him what I always say, respectfully, we Jews are much more interested in the quality of life before death than in theoretical rewards or punishments after death. But that's not really the whole story. I've often taught a class on Jewish views of life after death. It's an interesting subject, very interesting one, and one that Jews, particularly Reform and Conservative Jews, don't spend much time thinking about. Perhaps my favorite part about teaching this class is that no matter what I say about life after death and Jewish belief, nobody can prove I'm wrong or is inclined to do the research. When you have to die to prove somebody else wrong, you usually don't bother. In general, we Jews spend less time thinking about the afterlife than pretty much any other religious tradition of which I'm aware. It's difficult to imagine Christianity or Islam having developed without a strong belief in heaven and hell. The same applies to Hinduism and Buddhism. Virtually every religion has a highly developed conception of life after death, and for almost all of them, it's central to their beliefs. But for most Jews, the afterlife isn't a particularly significant part of our own foundational religious convictions. We figure we have a good deal of control over our own actions here in this world, and not much control over what happens after we die. Having said that, it would be incorrect to say that Jews don't believe in life after death, or heaven or hell. It's just that it's not nearly as important for us as it seems to be for many others. As the Talmud puts it neatly, those who don't believe in the world to come have no share in it, which seems completely fair to me. But when you study the question, it turns out that Jewish ideas about life after death are extensive and varied. While the Torah, our central and most ancient text, does not actually even mention life after death, over time, two central aspects of belief took hold in Judaism about the hereafter. One was the notion that our bodies would be resurrected, brought back to life in some way at some future time. The second was the idea that our souls, the part within each of us that is intrinsically and uniquely us, continues on after our physical death. Over time, these two ideas became linked into one system about what happens after we die. By the time that the book of Daniel in the last part of the Bible was written around 200 BCE, there was also a concept of Judgment Day. The scenario was we would die, our bodies get buried, and at some future date our souls would be returned to our bodies, restored with flesh and blood. We would then rise from the grave and be judged, and go on to either a good future or some kind of oblivion. I guess either the good place or the bad place. You might recognize most of this as what was later enshrined into Christianity, and they ran with it. It became central to Christian belief in an enhanced form, new and improved, with very vivid depictions of hell and very fleshed-out editions of heaven. Islam came along a bit later and amped up the heaven part, at least for men, while Christianity continued to elaborate on the hellfire and brimstone parts of things. But Judaism, which originated all of these ideas, never took to them as completely as our daughter religions did. While most Jews probably believed in these basic tenets, others did not. Varying interpretations of what it all meant and how it all worked developed. Rationalists, like Maimonides, believed the true heavenly ideal consisted of being in perfect connection with the great divine active intellect. Mystics believed our souls ascend to connect with the indwelling female presence of God. Later Kabbalists believed that we were reincarnated after death, our souls implanted in new bodies to live again and strive for perfection. In modern times, Orthodox Jews have continued to believe, at least officially, in the standard Jewish views of life after death, and to pray for bodily resurrection and the eternal soul. Most liberal Jews are much less likely to embrace the concept of bodily resurrection, but believe that they do have a soul. And there's a great deal of interest today in spirituality. I've met people who say they've had contact with relatives who are gone, who've experienced the sense of connection with children, spouses, siblings who've passed away. The greatest insight in exploring this subject this time around for me has been understanding that what we believe about life after death helps us understand what part of ourselves we truly believe is essential. What we think happens after we die says a great deal about who we believe we really are. And that reflection on ultimate ends can help us to understand how it is that we wish to live. Whether or not there really is a good place waiting for us down the road. To play us in this morning, here's Israeli singer Liron Amram and his song Chalom Yashan, an old dream, well, about relationships and things we forget and remember.
אנשים מדברים לא רוצה לשמוע איך מילים נזרקות בכזאת קלות לא מוצא פתרון לא רוצה לקבוע רק מנסה לקרוא נכון את המציאות יש דברים נסתרים לא רוצה לדעת השקרים לבושים במיליון צורות את השקט שלי אם את לא שומעת אחכה לך גם ימים וגם לילות עד שיפלו החומות ואז תבואי אליי שערי לידי ואל תגידי אולי וזיכרון שהולך ובא ולא עוזב שאת לא כאן זה עושה לי רק יותר כואב אז תעזבי הכל השמיים קודרים מתכסים לרגע הגלים נשברים למיליון סודות כינורות מנגנים נשמעים ברקע והשמיים
הלב שבור לאלף חתיכות. הימים משתנים והזמן נוסע, הלילות ארוכים, השעות עוברות, גם עברו השנים וכבר לא יודע כמה זמן אפשר לשבת לחכות. עד שיפלו החומות ואז תבואי אליי,
That was Liron Amram singing Chalom Yashan, an old dream of eternity that disappears. Our guest this morning is Emily Wanderer Cohen, both a second and third generation survivor herself, a speaker and author. Her work began in overcoming her own trauma, and her new book and method highlight the ways in which all of us can overcome seemingly overwhelming challenges through writing. Hear her story, find out how her method works when we return in a moment on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball. Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Emily Wanderer Cohen has developed a fascinating and, I think, innovative way of dealing with the pain of being a second, third, and fourth generation Holocaust survivor. She has a new book out, From Generation to Generation, Healing Intergenerational Trauma Through Storytelling, and writing plays a huge role in this. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So you are both the child of a survivor and the grandchild of survivors. That's almost unique nowadays, isn't it?
It is, and I actually didn't even put that together until I was writing the flap copy for my book. I'd always focused on the fact that my mother was a survivor, and that's because she would talk about it in schools, and it was very much at the forefront of my childhood. But my grandparents also survived with my mother and went through different experiences. And my father actually left the country in 1938 for Cuba, which is a whole other story in and of itself. But, you know, nowadays we look at him as a survivor as well.
Right. Your story, and by the way, although this is so much about surviving that kind of received trauma, and has so much to teach, I think, anyone who's dealt with second or third generation, now I suppose fourth generation survivors, I think it's more universal than that. Your story starts with some really horrible experiences at the hands of your mom that you didn't really understand. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, my mom's favorite, I call it weapon of choice, was a fly swatter. And so when I misbehaved, or when she perceived that I misbehaved or talked back to her, the fly swatter would come out and she would chase me around the house waving the fly swatter, and it would hit me wherever it may. So whether it was my head, my face, my arm, didn't really matter. And beyond that, she also pulled on my hair. She would scratch me. And I could see when those moments would happen. She would, her eyes would glaze over. They almost became more gray than green. And I, as I got older, I realized, you know, she really wasn't there. She was somewhere else.
The realization of that, which came so much later, and many other things are delineated in your book, and you talk about, in the course of it, how writing them out helped relieve that and put it in perspective. We'll talk much more about that with you, Emily Cohen, author From Generation to Generation, Healing Intergenerational Trauma Through Storytelling, when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's T-O-O, jewishradio18@gmail. Or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts, top 10 in North America, according to Moment magazine. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You are just back from a trip to Europe and to the former Yugoslavia, which has, although I think most people in America don't realize it, an ancient and interesting Jewish community and a very interesting Jewish present. Tell us a little bit about that.
Right. Well, I actually have a long history with the Jewish community of the former Yugoslavia because when I worked for the World Union of Jewish Students, I brought a delegation of people from all over the Jewish world, like Great Britain, the U.S., Canada, South Africa, Argentina, and Israel, of course, and France, to a summer camp on the shores of the Adriatic that served the young Jews of what was then still one country. Yugoslavia has since, in a series of bloody battles,
horrifying wars, yeah,
disintegrated into lots of smaller countries, some of which are still being defined. But one of the many things that I found interesting is that people, both of my generation and their children's generation, still keep up the network of relationships with Jews their own age throughout the former Yugoslavia. They sort of don't consider the Jews of Bosnia or Croatia or Montenegro to be living in other countries. They're still in touch with them on a regular basis. And it's actually fascinating. There's a lot of reasons for that. One is the Soros Foundation camp in Hungary. It's Szarvas.
Yeah, Szarvas, which we've talked about before, right, here, and which still has tremendous influence in the Hungarian Jewish community.
Right. Well, so a lot of these kids spend their summers there, and they network with Jews from all over Southeastern Europe, but particularly from the former Yugoslavia, because essentially they all share a language that nobody else speaks. Now, granted, there are increasingly, and in some cases, artificial differences between Serbian and Croatian that used to be officially one language written in two alphabets. And certainly Macedonian and Slovenian are arguably really different languages. Bosnian is kind of a blend of Serbian and Croatian, doesn't really exist as a language. So when you're at a conference in Sarajevo, which is probably the best known and most ancient of these various Jewish communities, the local language is simply referred to as local languages, plural, to include Bosnian, Serbian, and Croatian.
Right.
And so anybody who wants one version of those languages listens to that channel. There aren't separate channels for Bosnian, Serbian, and Croatian.
Huh.
So Sarajevo used to be a very thriving Jewish community. And I think recently we talked about an interview with the head of the Jewish community there who said he believed it was the safest place in all of Europe to be Jewish these days.
It's possible.
And the Jewish community is growing back there, which is very rare in most of the former Yugoslavia. Apparently, young people are returning from Israel, and there's a kind of reverse immigration. A lot of people left during the conflicts in the 90s. And now that it's stabilized, they're coming back. It's a magical place, and it has a deep Jewish history. And my best and oldest friend in the former Yugoslavia, with whom I stayed in Belgrade, which is now the capital of Serbia, was the capital of former Yugoslavia, has personally an interesting relationship with both the community in Sarajevo and with Judaism in general, and particularly the question of his children and potential grandchildren, which I guess we'll talk about next week because it looks like we're running out of time.
Yes, absolutely. You know, the first thing I think of was Sarajevo is a Sarajevo Haggadah, but because that was sort of a symbol of a very rich culture. We will continue this next week. Thanks,
Tom. I look
Tom.
Forward to it.
We welcome our Mivina and Israel Oshrat Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
So there's lots of trips to Israel, synagogue trips, community trips, people lead trips to Israel. There's lots of ways of traveling.
Because it's the 70 years old.
It's the 70th birthday of Israel in just a couple of months. It's a very exciting time. Why are you leading a trip to Israel yourself? I've led some myself. You can tell me why you lead a trip to Israel.
So the idea that the Israel Center will take some trips is, first of all, that it's really open to all, you know, all faiths or like everyone. And we are not leading any agenda, you know, other than really creating like living bridges for people. So everyone can find, you know, explore and find his own Israel, as I like
so
to say.
So it's not a trip to bring you closer
it's
to your religious experience.
It's not a federation trip.
It's not a Christian trip. It's not a specifically
it's
Jewish
really,
trip only.
It's really, we really wanted to...
It's not to try to get you to give more money to an organization.
Mamashlo.
Right.
Mamashlo. It's like, we just wanted to make sure that we are living our mission statement, and we are creating enough living bridges, and we want to take as many people that, again, that they will explore their, you know, with their own heart, eyes, and legs, Israel. And we are hoping to take 80 people. And even though we're hoping to take 80 people, and I feel like we are in the right way to take 80 people, we created 4 different tracks every day, so people won't feel that they are on a big trip. They will be always be with the small groups, you know, and we try to combine, you know, very balanced itineraries. So first timers will, you know, will see the must-see sites, but those who are going for the 20th time will still be able to learn something about Israel.
So when do you go?
So October 14th of 2018. It's 8 days on the ground. And for more information, it's very affordable trip, by the way. It's $2,850 for land only. But it includes like a 4-stars hotels, which is really nice.
Nice.
Yeah, nice. And affordable. I think it's affordable.
So October's a nice time to go. This is after all the Chagim.
Yes.
It's after Sukkot
and
Simchat Torah. Nahum. But weather is beautiful everywhere in Israel.
Yeah,
then.
It's like, what, is low 70s?
Yeah, like 70s in the 70s. Day and maybe in the 50s at night.
50s
and
at night.
Maybe a little cooler in Jerusalem, a little warmer in Tel
Nahum.
Aviv. Definitely warmer in Eilat, but otherwise, beautiful.
That's a good point. We are also offering extension to Petra. You reminded me. So
Petra.
For more information, go to jfsa.org and click on Weintraub Israel Center, and there is Israel Experience.
So where is your favorite place to take people in Israel? Is it Beit She'an, your hometown?
It's a hard. It seems like a simple one, but the I think the place that it touches me very much, first of all, to see Israel through other people's eyes, mainly non-Israelis, it's definitely
great.
That's that's the best for me. But taking people to Beit She'an, sometime to my mom's house, and last time to, you know,
to the Ethiopian,
Ethiopian but friend, to my mom's house, and it's like, it's funny, it's very personal, but I feel it's the first time it combined the two worlds that I'm living in, you know.
Israel and America, huh?
Not just Israel, but my home here and my home there. And it's I felt like I need to separate them. And now it was like, oh, they click together. So that was like a very special moment.
Beautiful. Thanks, Oshrat. And people can go to jfsa.org for more information.
Toda rabah.
Vivakasha. We'll talk next week. It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. The rabbi just finished speaking to Hebrew school class when little David raised his hand. Yes, David, what would you like to ask? I have 4 questions, Rabbi. First, is it true that after the children of Israel crossed the Red Sea, they received the 10 commandments? Yes, David, said the rabbi. Next, is it true that the children of Israel also defeated the Philistines? Yes, David, that's also true. Third, it was the children of Israel who fought the Romans and fought the Egyptians and built the temple?
Again, you are correct, David. Very good. Well, my last question is, Rabbi, what did the grown-ups do all that time? That was the old Jewish joke of the week. Special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the portion of Yitro, the great moment of the revelation at Mount Sinai, which includes the climactic events of the Ten Commandments and the Theophany at Sinai, the most direct revelation of God to us of all. It's a testament to brevity and concision, just a few paragraphs of text, but it is these few words that have become the essence of Western religious experience ever since, our most complete connection to God. In today's world, the whole concept of revelation is complicated, challenging for most of us. Do you personally believe in revelation at all? That is, that God revealed or reveals God's greater power, will, and plan to us directly? Skeptics, which at heart includes most of us, can highlight a series of improbabilities in the central tale of this epical Jewish narrative of revelation. Are we to actually believe that at Mount Sinai, God revealed God's essence to us directly? That somehow, in some supernatural way, a group of Israelite freed slaves communicated with a being greater than themselves, and it only happened once, more than 3,000 years ago? Are we also to believe that not only did the Israelites think God connected with them, but also that God spoke actual words, and our ancestors not only understood them, but committed them to memory? Clearly, our tradition teaches that there have been moments of overwhelming connection to God. And the greatest of these is the Ma'amad Har Sinai, the event of standing at Sinai, which most people believe took place, if it happened, about 3,200 years ago. Our ancestors certainly believed that God spoke directly to them, and that a certain covenant, a moral contract, was created in that spectacular moment. You know, there's many ways to view revelation. While the text of Parshat Yitro, this week's portion in Exodus, sees the experience of Sinai as a unique one, filled with dramatic pronouncements, lightning, thunder, earthquakes, and so on, Jewish tradition has always taught that each of us stood at Sinai, including all the generations of Jews not yet born. In other words, we are all participants in revelation in our own way. Just as we all must see ourselves as having come out of Egypt as freed slaves, so we all must come to understand our relationship with God directly. Revelation, God's will revealed to us for our own lives, must be given to us and accepted by each of us directly. My grandfather, Rabbi and Professor Samuel S. Kohan, had a concept of progressive revelation. Each of us in every generation has the ability to conceive of and perceive God in his or her own way. Moses' generation called it revelation at Sinai. Our generation might call it divine inspiration, or perhaps even creativity, a way to channel the divine energy that flows through our world always, and sometimes gifts us with a spark of greatness or genius. Is that revelation today for you or for me? Perhaps. When we feel that remarkable connection to the universe that allows us to create, to write, to sing, to play music, to dance, to love freely, we are experiencing a kind of revelation. When we feel unlimited and amazing love for a child, for a spouse or a friend, it is an experience of revelation. God is revealed to us in the holiness we can touch in our own lives. Revelation simply means knowing God's presence through beauty, inspiration, caring, and love. May we each be blessed with these experiences of revelation in our own lives. When we return on Too Jewish, our guest, Emily Wanderer Cohen, will explain how writing helped her overcome great trauma and how it can help not only the children and grandchildren of Holocaust survivors, but through her methodology, everyone who has suffered traumatic experience. Find out just how when we come back in a moment on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Our
The gap between Republicans and Democrats' views about Israel is widening, a Pew Research Center poll released last week discovered. The poll showed that 79% of Republicans sympathize with Israel over the Palestinians, but only 27% of Democrats sympathize with Israel over the Palestinians. That is the widest divide on opinions about Israel since 1978. The share of Republicans who sympathize with Israel has never been higher, dating back through four decades of polling. Pew poll also showed that 42% of independents sympathize with Israel more than Palestinians. The drop among Democrats was especially sharp in recent years. In April 2016, 43% of Democrats said they were likelier to sympathize with Israel. That has now fallen to just 16%. The rise among Republicans has also been sharp since 2001. In that year, 50% of Republicans said they sympathize more with Israel, and now it's up an additional 29% from that. This year's poll shows 16% of Republicans sympathize with Palestinians more, and 25% of Democrats sympathize with the Palestinians more. Overall, 46% of Americans sympathize more with Israel, about the same as it has been overall since 78. We Americans continue to be divided in our views on whether or not a way can be found for Israel and an independent Palestinian state to coexist peacefully. About half say it's possible. About 40% say no. In other news, the secular religious divide in Israel continues to widen. Last week, a meeting between Israel's Sephardic chief rabbi and the Israeli army's chief rabbi was canceled after the defense minister banned the chief rabbi from military ceremonies. Defense Minister Avigdor Lieberman banned Chief Rabbi Yitzchak Yosef and two other rabbis from the military events after they criticized the Israel Defense Forces' mixed-gender units. The scheduled meeting was then canceled. Rabbi Shmuel Eliyahu, Chief Rabbi of Tzfat and a member of the Chief Rabbinical Council, said in an interview last week with Army Radio that Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu should fire IDF Chief of Staff Lieutenant General Gadi Eisenkot over his decision to allow female soldiers into combat units. Rabbi Shlomo Aviner wrote on the Orthodox news website Kippah that it was forbidden to join mixed-gender units and said it was better to refuse to serve than enter a mixed-gender unit. Aviner is the rabbi of the Beit El settlement and head of the somewhat nutcase Ateret Kohanim Yeshiva, which wants to rebuild the temple in Jerusalem as soon as possible. Avigdor Lieberman said rabbis who are state employees must represent the state. Reasonable, and therefore would not be allowed at official events until they withdraw their comments. They are state employees who, among other things, receive a salary from taxpayers, he said. Eliyahu's office reportedly threatened to file a lawsuit against Lieberman unless he rescinds the order. Actually, the Haredi ultra-Orthodox response to the Israeli military's policies, well, it borders on treason, and it demonstrates the continued inability of the rabbinate to recognize women as fully capable human beings. It seems very unlikely that any lawsuit filed in secular Israeli courts against Defense Minister Lieberman will succeed.
Hooray for Hollywood, that's gooey ballyhooly Hollywood, where any office boy or young mechanic can be a panic with just a good-looking pan.
It's entertainment awards season, and the Oscar nominations came out last week. That followed the Golden Globe Awards, which included wins by Jewish actor James Franco in the Best Actor category, and our favorite TV show, The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, whose stars were here on Too Jewish less than 2 months ago, deservedly won for Best TV Comedy or Musical. The Oscar nominations, unsurprisingly, had many Jewish actors, films, writers, musicians, and songs nominated. Perhaps the most Jewishly linked of all last year, Call Me By Your Name, a movie based on the novel by Jewish-Egyptian author Andre Assi and featuring Jewish actor Timothy Chalamet, nominated for Best Actor, and the half-Jewish actor Armie Hammer, while that film was nominated for Best Picture and three other Oscars.
Oh, to see without my eyes the first time that you kissed me, boundless by the time I cried, I built your walls around. White noise, what an awful sound. Fumbling by Rogue River, feel my feet above the ground. Hand of God, deliver me. Oh, 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 is me. The first time that you touched me. Oh,
Along with the usual high number of our co-religionists featured in the nominations, there were a couple of Oscar snubs as well. While The Post was nominated for Best Picture, director Steven Spielberg was not nominated for Best Director. And while James Franco, as we said, actually won the Golden Globe for his performance in The Disaster Artist, he was not nominated for an Oscar for it. That's widely viewed as backlash from allegations that he too has been involved in sexual misconduct, and the ever-growing Me Too movement has likely influenced that choice. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Emily Wander Cohen is the author of From Generation to Generation, Healing Intergenerational Trauma Through Storytelling with Dor Vador. She herself, as we heard earlier in the show, is both a second and third generation survivor. In the course of dealing with all of this kind of accumulated hiddenness, because you didn't really understand, there's a part where you talk about how your mom wouldn't wear anything with vertical stripes or have any furniture with vertical stripes because it reminded her of the clothing in the concentration camp. You didn't understand this stuff because she didn't talk about it, or she wasn't even aware of it herself?
She didn't make that connection. There was never a reason. So we would go to Nordstrom. I would find something I liked with stripes, and she would just say, "Ach, no." And there was no arguing with her, and there was no because. It was actually, I think if I asked, she would have said, because I said so, which is, you know, classic of that generation growing up. Our parents really didn't explain themselves and didn't feel. exactly. So that was really when I started writing, that I made that connection. And it happened when I was on a website, just randomly going through looking for a dress, and I saw this vertically striped, it was gray and blue dress, and I immediately felt my body react to it. And I knew what was happening at that moment, and that's when all the pieces fell in place for me. That's what was happening when I was a child with my mother.
How long did it take you to figure out that speaking about it, and especially writing about it, would help relieve the internal conflict over this trauma?
Probably about, a couple months into writing. I began writing actually as many children and grandchildren of survivors do. I was attempting to document my mother's story for posterity. And I started writing, I believe it was The Fly Swatter, and my neighbor read it, who was a writing coach or an English teacher, and she said, "Where are you in the story?" And it was all very third person. And I said, "Well, it's not my story, it's my mom's." And she said, "No, you're the one who's being abused here. You're the one, it is your story. There's a reason." And so I changed my mindset about how I was going to write. And I realized that by connecting the dots backward, it really helped me understand why my mom behaved that way. And then it helped me forgive her, because she knew when she was going to be in that place. She couldn't control it. And that was part of the healing, was that instead of the anger at having been, you know, abused as a child emotionally and physically, that I was able to see that, you know, she was abused and incarcerated and, you know, probably raped. She never admitted to that, but I wouldn't be surprised if that were true. And, you know, the old adage, hurt people hurt people. And so it becomes this waterfall effect And I was able to see that that was what happened. Unfortunately, I didn't come to that until after she'd already passed.
In a way, of course, it'd be better to have her achieved it while she was alive. It's extremely important, even after somebody dies, to begin to find that closure. You discovered a whole lot of secrets in the course of this, didn't you?
I sure did. I keep waiting for the third, you know. it actually started when I was in Germany visiting my cousins. My grandfather was actually born Catholic and converted to Judaism to marry my grandmother in 1920, I think. 1919, yeah, right after the war.
Just after World War One.
Yeah, just after World War One. And so I still have a tremendous amount of family in Germany and Poland, none of whom are Jewish, but I'm fairly close with my cousin in Frankfurt. And so I told him I wanted to go see a cousin of my mother's, Ria, who my mom always went to visit and just adored her. And we were sitting around a table and she took me upstairs to look at some photos that she had of my mom. And there is a photo of my mom with her first husband, Peter, who I had only just found out about a couple years before from my cousin, that there were pictures of the two of them together. And I said, yeah, it's just, you know, too bad that, you know, he died in the camp, which is the story my mom always told me. And Ria looked at me. I think her jaw was open. She goes, what? He didn't die.
Oh, my God. Right.
And, you know, I didn't react right then. I was kind of like, you know, whose memory is, you know, she's 89. My mom was older, you know, maybe it's a memory thing. And just by chance, I was at the U.S. Holocaust Museum. I try to go every time I'm in D.C. And I was up at the research desk doing some research on my mom and my grandmother and just pulling reams of paper. And at the last second, I thought, gosh, I could either do more research on my grandmother or I could just put in Peter's name and see what happens. And so the woman types in Peter's name and nothing comes up. And I kind of went, oh, see, I knew. Okay, mom was right. I kind of just relaxed for a second. And she said, wait, let me try this other database. And she put his name in, and all of a sudden, the screen filled, and I fell apart. For a couple of reasons. Because, one, my mom had kept this secret. And, you know, at this point, I still didn't know what had transpired. I had a plane to catch, and this kind woman printed out this whole stack of paper on him, and while I called a cab. And so I was sad that, and I was sad for her loss, for a loss of a love and a life, and, you know, just how quickly things can change. In one instant that she said, I'm going to escape. I know the Russians are coming and it's a chance to get out. And him saying no, that's what she always said. But he was then by the Russians and sent to a work camp in Siberia. Could you imagine going from concentration camp to a Russian work camp?
Yeah. In Siberia.
And I just can't even imagine.
So he survived, although she said he didn't. Did she know that he had survived?
So based on the papers that were printed out for me at the Holocaust Museum, she did. Because he had some papers that said would like to emigrate to America with his wife and had her street address in Seattle. So I can only guess how that all happened. It has to do with my grandfather's family, but she definitely knew. And so conjecture, she just said, please don't come. I have a new life. Because she didn't hear from him for 5 years. He was in Siberia.
Right.
So she just stuck with that narrative. You know, those 5 years, she figured he died, and she moved on. And so there was no reason to tell me differently or to change her narrative in her eyes.
That must have taken a lot of writing to get that off of your chest.
Yeah. It did. It did. But it also helped that my cousin in Germany helped me find Peter's children. Mm-hmm. Peter, I knew it was a race against time when I realized that he was, you know, he had survived, and he actually passed in the 70s. So I didn't feel like I missed him by, you know, a couple of weeks or a year. And, but we did, I did meet with them. And not surprisingly, Peter married a Christian woman, and their family became evangelical Christian. And I guess, you know, after going through the concentration camp and then Siberia, you know, the persecution, I can kind of, I'm not saying that I would do that, but I, you know, we don't know what we would do in those situations, do we? But I just wasn't surprised.
You grew up in Portland, Oregon. By the way, in the interest of full disclosure, my grandmother was born in Portland in 1890. So there are Jewish roots there, but it's not exactly like growing up in, you know, Brooklyn or West Los Angeles or, I don't know, Skokie, Illinois, or somewhere where there's lots of, where there's such a strong Jewish identity. You were the only Jewish kid in most of your schools. But so it was sort of natural to kind of hide the fact that your mom was a Holocaust survivor?
Yeah. So it was actually more of a function of where we lived in Portland. There's actually a pretty strong Jewish community closer to downtown, mm-hmm. closer in where most of the temples are, right? My dad had decided to build a house out in, I call it the boonies now, but it's not the boonies anymore. It's pretty built up. But so we were very far out, 45 minutes out from downtown, half hour, 45 minutes. And so, yeah, it was a farming area. And people, I vividly remember, for some reason, more in high school, but that's probably because of tests and things. But, you know, when I would miss school for Rosh Hashanah or Yom Kippur, I would get ridiculed and teased and, oh, you just wanted a day off. And even the teachers didn't understand back then. And I know that my friends who went to high schools that were closer to the rest of the Jewish community, you know, had a different experience. And at one point, I actually asked my mom, I wanted to transfer high schools so that I could be with more Jews. And also, it was a little more academically rigorous. And she said no, because it would have impacted her. She would have had to drive me. And that just was not going to happen. And I wasn't strong enough in those days to approach a friend's mother or grandmother or something and say, can we carpool? Can you drive me? It wasn't in my consciousness, and I didn't do it. So yeah, it was very isolating, and I didn't talk about it. But my mom did come into schools and speak about her experience, but I would not go see her. I wouldn't.
It'd be too much? Too weird? Or she didn't want you to.
No, it was me. Hmm. I mean, I knew her story for a long time. We would talk about it at home almost every day. No, I didn't want that connection. I was already feeling so different, and I didn't want to make that even stronger. Like if I attached to her or I went there, then I would have to answer more questions, and I didn't really want to.
A final question. I feel like we could talk a great deal longer, but we're almost out of time. When people approach you, when you speak about this, and now that the book is out, how do you tell them to start?
That's an excellent question. What I have my clients start with is sitting down and thinking about a particularly vivid experience that they had with their parent or grandparent that they can feel like it was yesterday. And very often that's a traumatic experience. Sometimes it's just something like overly loving. But I have them start with what the first image, the first event that they can really picture. And then I have them go from there.
I want to thank Emily Wanderer Cohen for a great visit here on Too Jewish. Her book is called From Generation to Generation, Healing Intergenerational Trauma Through Storytelling. Where can people go to find out more about you and your work?
They can go to my website, which is fromgentogenbook.com, and that's from GENTOGENbook.com.
Emily, thank you so much, and continued success in helping people free themselves from these traumas.
Thank you so much for having me, Rabbi.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest and get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday. Our guest will be Rabbi Manis Friedman, author of The Joy of Intimacy, A Soulful Guide to Love, Sex, and Marriage. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or at our TooJewishRadio.com website. Our playout this morning comes from Israeli singer Gil Vane. His song from last year, Al Tishali, Don't Ask. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week we pray of peace.
קראתי ספר וראיתי סרט, הסדר יום שלי עובר אחרת. אני לוקח יותר את הזמן מאז שאת לא כאן. לקחתי כמה שיעורים בגיטרה, הייתי כמה שעות מול הים. אני מכיר את הלבד בעולם מאז שאת לא כאן. אל תשאלי, התחלתי לאשר וליהנות מהקפה. ועוד שבוע בעזרת השם אני טס לי למקום יפה. בדיוק כשהתחלתי להבין מה אני רוצה מעצמי ובעיקר ממך, ומה הרגשתי בכלל כל הזמן הזה אליי. אתמול בבוקר אחרי שלא ראיתי איזה חודש, יצאתי לריצה, ראיתי אנשים שלא ראיתי מזמן. הם מספרים שגם את בסדר, לא חיה את החיים לפי הספר. כי אולי אם כן אז עוד היית כאן. אל תשאלי, התחלתי לאשן וליהנות מהקפה. ועוד שבוע בעזרת השם אני טסתי למקום יפה. בדיוק
sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.